I would like to read from the autobiography of a yogi this evening. It's a chapter entitled The Resurrection of Sri Yukteswar. And this narrates an account of an amazing occurrence where Yogananda's guru, Sri Yukteswar, who had left the body and whose body had been buried, resurrected himself in physical form and was describing to him the nature of the astral and causal realms. And here Yogananda is asking him about karma. Resurrected one, I want to know more about the karma which forces souls to return to the three worlds. I could listen forever, I thought, to my omniscient master. Never in his earth life had I been able at one time to simulate so much of his wisdom. Now, for the first time, I was receiving a clear, definite insight into the enigmatic inner spaces on the checkerboard of life and death. Sri Yukteswar. The physical karma or desires of man must be completely worked out before his permanent stay in the astral worlds becomes possible, my guru elucidated in his thrilling voice. Two kinds of beings live in the astral spheres, those who still have earthly karma to dispose of, and who must therefore re-inhabit a gross physical body in order to pay their karmic debts, could be classified after physical death as temporary visitors to the astral world rather than as permanent residents. Beings with unredeemed earthly karma are not permitted after astral death to go to the high causal sphere of cosmic ideas, but must shuttle to and fro from the physical and astral worlds only, conscious successively of their physical body of 16 gross elements and their astral body of 19 subtle elements. After each loss of his physical body, however, an undeveloped being from the earth remains for the most part in deep stupor of the death sleep and is hardly conscious of the beautiful astral sphere. After the astral rest, such a man returns to the material plane for further lessons, gradually accustoming himself through repeated journeys to the worlds of subtle astral texture. Normal or long-established residents of the astral universe, on the other hand, are those who, freed forever from all material longings, need return no more to the gross vibrations of Earth. Such beings have only astral and causal karma to work out. And these beings pass to the infinitely finer and more delicate causal world, shedding the thought form of the causal body at the end of a certain span, determined by cosmic law. These advanced beings then return to higher Niloka, or a similar high astral planet, reborn in a new astral body to work out their unredeemed astral karma. My son, you may now comprehend more fully that I am resurrected by divine decree, Sri Yukteswar continued, as a savior of astrally reincarnating souls coming back from the causal sphere, in particular, rather than those of astral beings who are coming up from the earth. Those from the earth, if they still retain vestiges of material karma, do not rise to the very high astral plane planets like Hiranyaloka. Just as most people on earth have not learned through meditation acquired vision to appreciate the superior joys and advantages of astral life and thus, after death, desire to return to the limited, imperfect pleasures of earth. So many astral beings, during their normal disintegration of their astral bodies, fail to picture the advanced state of spiritual joy in the causal world, and dwelling on thoughts of more gross and gaudy astral happiness, yearn to revisit the astral paradise. Heavy astral karma must be redeemed by such beings before they can achieve, after astral death, a permanent stay in the causal thought world, so thinly partitioned from the Creator. Only when a being has no further desires for experiences in the pleasing to the eye astral cosmos and cannot be tempted to go back there does he remain in the causal world, completing there the work of redeeming all causal karma or seeds of past desires. The confined soul thrusts out the last of the three corks of ignorance and, emerging from the final jar of causal body, commingles with the eternal. Now do you understand? Master smiled so enchantingly. Yes, through your grace, I am speechless with joy and gratitude. Never from song or story had I received such inspiring knowledge, though the Hindu scriptures refer to the causal and astral worlds and to man's three bodies. How remote and meaningless those pages compared with the warm authenticity of my resurrected master. For him, indeed, existed not a single undiscovered country from whose born no traveler returns. The interpenetration of man's three bodies is expressed in many ways through his threefold nature, my great guru went on. In the wakeful state on earth, a human being is conscious more or less of his three vehicles. When he is sensuously intent on tasting, smelling, touching, listening, or seeing, he is working principally through his physical body. Visualizing or willing, he is working mainly through his astral body. His causal medium finds expression when man is thinking or diving deep in introspection or meditation. The cosmical thoughts of genius come to man who habitually contacts his causal body. In this sense, an individual may be classified broadly as a material man, an energetic man, or an intellectual man. A man identifies himself about 16 hours daily with his physical body, then he sleeps. If he dreams, he remains in his astral body, effortlessly creating any objects, even as do astral beings. If man's sleep be deep and dreamless, for several hours he is able to transfer his consciousness or sense of I-ness to the causal body. Such sleep is revivifying. A dreamer is contacting his astral body and not his causal body. His sleep is not fully refreshing. I had been lovingly observing Sri Yukteswar while he gave his wondrous exposition. Angelic Guru, I said, your body looks exactly as it did when I last wept over it in the Puri Ashram. Oh yes, my new body is a perfect copy of the old one. I materialize or dematerialize this form any time at will, much more frequently than I did while on earth. By quick dematerialization, I now travel instantly by light express from planet to planet, or indeed from astral to causal or to the physical cosmos. My divine guru smiled. Though you move about so fast these days, I had no difficulty finding you at Bombay. Oh, Master, I was grieving so deeply about your death. Ah, wherein did I die? Isn't there some contradiction? Sri Yukteswar's eyes were twinkling with love and amusement. You are only dreaming on earth. On that earth you saw my dream body, he went on. Later, you buried that dream image. Now my finer fleshly body, which you behold and are even now embracing rather closely, is resurrected on another finer dream planet of God. Someday that finer dream body and finer dream planet will pass away. They too are not forever. All dream bubbles must eventually burst at the final wakeful touch. Differentiate, my son Yogananda, between dreams and reality. This idea of Vedantic resurrection struck me with wonder. I was ashamed that I had pitied Master when I had seen his lifeless body at Puri. I comprehended at last that my guru had always been fully awake in God, perceiving his own life and passing on earth and his present resurrection as nothing more than relativities of divine ideas in a cosmic dream. I have now told you, Yogananda, the truths of my life, death, and resurrection. Grieve not for me. Rather, broadcast everywhere the story of my resurrection from God-dreamed earth of men to another God-dream planet of astrally garbed souls. New hope will be infused in the hearts of misery-mad, death-fearing dreamers of the world. Yes, Master, how willingly would I share with others my joy at his resurrection. On earth, my standards were uncomfortably high, unsuited to the natures of most men. Often I scolded you more than I should have. You passed my test. Your love shone through the clouds of all reprimands. He added tenderly, I have also come today to tell you, never again shall I wear the stern gaze of censure. I shall scold you no more. How much I had missed the chastisements of my great guru. Each one had been a guardian angel of protection. Dearest master, rebuke me a million times. Do scold me now. I shall chide you no more. His divine voice was grave, yet with an undercurrent of laughter. You and I shall smile together, so long as our two forms appear different in the Maya dream of God. Finally, we shall merge as one in the cosmic beloved. Our smile shall be his smile, our unified song of joy vibrating throughout eternity to be broadcast to God-tuned souls. And a poem entitled Soul Search. Though my soul's search be true, yet many a path have I wandered afar, forgetting veritable truths until sense drunk, stumbling, I have lost my way. Oh, how many times will I strive and fall short of the lofty goal, falling into worn ruts of old, finding strength and vision waned, forgetful of original thought, neglectful of things eternal. Oh, how long, Lord, will I stray against my own conscious will? I pray for my portion of thee, my inheritance I ask of thee, true nature to be revealed, knower of sublime worlds and beyond. O infinite King of sages and saints, many have striven and fallen short. Even of those who have attained to thee, having previously tried and failed. One thing I know for certain, oh, one truth is lodged in my heart. Beyond all doubt, you have smitten me, and I will die in my search for the infinite beyond. I am but a human, frail and dark. Of foibles and errors do I possess. Yet one gift appears above all those lesser ones, my desire for thee alone. Minor fiefdoms strive to conquest soul. Petty princes try to grasp the whole. But no reach can circumference that kingdom, shining as my eternal abode. Someday the rightful ruler of old will again stand preeminent to all, to reclaim its rebellious land, to rule by truth, and peace will resound its own echo. Like a pied piper of old will my soul call to scattered mice of sense-drunk life, and lead those wayward creatures to the sea that is one for us all. Standing firm upon the crown of glory, freedom at last reigning in my soul, order of mind, sense, and desire restored, brought back into the fold of the One. So to all my brethren do I call, shy from error and cling unto the truth. Let go of all that holds us in bondage, and to our infinite reach let us be away. I'd like to speak this evening on ascending your spinal stairway. When we are born into this world, we come in bare conscious awareness of who and what we are. And as we acclimate ourselves to this body and this culture, our language, the social mores that we all abide by, we gradually take on a greater identity of ourselves as a body, as a name, as an occupation, as a particular sex, a particular race, a particular religion, and all the rest of it. And so we are acclimatized to thinking about ourselves as identified with this body and with an identity that we have formed around it. But what is the true and lasting nature of this? It is but something that we have in conscious memory only known but a short time. And yet, within most of us resides a memory, maybe perhaps just a feeling, that there is something beyond what it is that we have brought into this world and learned about ourselves in the way that we have. So many times people reach their goals in this life, only then to be dissatisfied with what they have gotten. And then they think, well, I just need to attain something more, a further goal, perhaps another degree, another job, another position, perhaps leaving spouse and house and children and going off into a new adventure. And so through one adventure after another, we try to find that happiness. And we try to find it through the sense life, through the life of the mind and of the emotions. But if we are of a spiritual nature, and that is beginning to become part of our conscious mind, these things do not entirely satisfy us. We have an inner yearning for something more, something greater. There is an intuitive quest that we begin that tells us there is something more to this life. What is this more? Sometimes we look for particular philosophies or particular religion, perhaps, or we just have a vague knowingness that there is something more to this life. But it is difficult to identify, difficult to name. Perhaps we take on a particular kind of philosophy, and we think, well, this is it. This is the closest thing that I can come to. But unless that philosophy is practical, unless it leads us beyond what we have known into the undiscovered country of who and what we are in reality, then it will never completely satisfy. Taking on a new philosophy, taking on new ideas will give us a short bit of comfort, but it will not satisfy that soul's yearning, that soul's longing for something greater, for something more, that we all yearn for deep within us. If we dare dream of things beyond what we have known up until now, then perhaps we set out on even a greater adventure. We go beyond this body, we go beyond these feelings, and we go beyond these thoughts, and we begin to think of ourselves as something greater than all of these things, and yet intimately connected with each one of them. And so we find that we are perhaps put onto the spiritual path. We find that someone that we encounter speaks the truth to us. In my own case, finding a spiritual teacher was the hallmark of my life. For me, this was the thing that I desired beyond all other things. When I looked about me as I was emerging into adulthood, I saw no other adults in my life that I aspired to be like, and it was a very sad thing. The thought of gaining a job and a position, money and all the rest of it, had no appeal for me, because it seemed as an empty vessel that was not filled with anything that had meaning or purpose or appealed to that inner yearning. When I met my own spiritual teacher for the first time, I felt that the truth was being enunciated as what I had felt only vaguely and intuitively within me. There was an unrest in my soul. There is an unrest deep within me that I could not quite name. I could not quite give form to. And actually, this is a saving grace, because if we are too quickly to name it, if we are too quickly to form ideas around it, then we solidify that, and we give it an image, we give it a form that begins to limit us, even as we begin our search. So it can be very frustrating in the beginning to have just this intuitive, vague knowing that there is something greater. And yet, if we hang on to that and refuse to too quickly give it a name, give it a form, give it an idea, then we leave ourselves open for that greater something within us. Now, when we meet a spiritual teacher, it is as if we're meeting someone who is a light with a fire, and we are as dry kindling if we are of the proper mind and of the proper mood. And those sparks from the fire strike that dry kindling within us, and it begins to start an internal combustion. And from that, we begin to feel uplifted in our consciousness and purified within our mind. We feel inspired to seek something beyond ourselves and to go further along our own path. We feel as though, for the first time perhaps, we are awakened to who and what we truly are. We begin to be uplifted into higher spiritual realms. When I met my own spiritual teacher, upon hearing her speak, I felt myself afterwards uplifted and lifted out of my body and beyond. It felt as if I was looking to the world through a telescope 1,000 miles away. And I did not know the nature of this transformation. I didn't have a context for it, but I knew something powerful had happened in my life and that this was an influence that I was looking for. It spoke to me of deeper volumes than what I had yet read about or even encountered. And so I set out on a spiritual journey. I didn't know the truth of it. I didn't know the whole of it. And yet I was willing to set out on that journey because I wanted to have that experience. And with everything in me, there was not any other desire that was greater. It does not mean that there were not competing desires. There certainly were. And it was a tremendous struggle to get vacillated between the two poles of opposites, to feel uplifted in God and to feel that consciousness and that expansion, to hear the sound of many rushing waters with the inner ear, the sound of Om, as it resonated within me and all about me. I felt a spiritual current within my own spine begin to uplift me. But even as those moments were when I was uplifted, so was I taken down into the depths of my own soul, to the darkness of my own under regions, where I had to find my and fight my own devils, my own darkness of my own creation. And so being lifted up and then thrust down and back and forth. And this is the spiritual path. Sometimes we read about spiritual teachings and they act as if it is all bliss. It is all God all the way. And that's all that we experience. But this isn't the truth of it. Because in every individual's experience, as they seek to go into this higher consciousness, there is a price to be paid. Now, this is not an arbitrary price, but rather it is this karmic debt that we have come with. Now, what is the source of this karmic debt? We are told that for every action, there is an opposite and equal reaction. Jesus expressed it as saying, as you sow, so shall you reap. And so if we go through any religion throughout the world, we see that the same basic principle is spoken of. And so for every thought, every action that we put out and send forth from us, there comes back that opposite and equal reaction. And so we have to face ourselves. We have to face all of those things that we have done. And that includes not only in this lifetime, but in lifetimes from previous pasts. It may sound as a strange thing, but because our conscious memory only goes back so far, does not mean that that is the sum total of us. That we are like an iceberg with just a little bit of what's showing in our conscious mind. You even think about this own lifetime, and how much of this own lifetime do you remember? And do you have conscious access to at any particular time? And if you are put into a deeply relaxed state, you may go back and have memories of early childhood that before had been inaccessible to you. And perhaps you'll have a smell come to you, maybe. Any time that I smell something that is that kind of musty, dampish kind of smell, it takes me back to my grandmother's basement that I loved so much to play in when I was a young child. And so that smell is a powerful prompter to take me down into the unconscious mind. And there the memories are sprung loose. Now, normally I don't carry those conscious memories around with me, but they lie deeply embedded within the unconscious. And so we may have experiences in this lifetime that actually trigger memories of going back beyond even this lifetime into previous times when we had experiences that put those memories deep within our own consciousness, but they are not normally in our own awareness. Now, we do not have to seek out after these memories consciously. If we are in need of having any memories of our previous lifetimes, they will come to us spontaneously, and when we are ready for them, they will come to us unbidden. But we will be consciously ready for them. There are two dangers in mucking around in our past in that way. One is that we are truly not consciously ready to absorb the material that comes to us from that. There have been lifetimes that we have lived that are hard to take, and they are not easy for conscious assimilation. There are also memories that we can get distracted from. You are the sum total of every life that you have ever lived, and so that is at your beck and call even now. All the qualities, all the pieces of memory, all the learnings that you have had over lifetimes are available to you if you but become calm and quiet and tune into that. But there is no need to consciously try to go back and recover those memories. However, there may be times when it's useful. I've had several experiences of this nature. When I was having a back problem and I had a lot of pain in my fifth lumbar and was having difficulty with that, it triggered, when I was in meditation, a spontaneous regression, so to speak, where I viewed a previous lifetime in which I had been struck down in that same spot within my spine. And by having that memory consciously recovered, it helped to give me a context for what I was experiencing at that time. Now, it didn't release me from the pain, and it didn't release me from that experience, but it gave me a helpful way of beginning to thinking about it and what my challenge was about it. You see, I had been involved in a political upheaval where I was out to take more power, and I was doing it by force. And when I was struck down in this way, I spent the rest of my lifetime immobilized from the waist down. And there was a lot of shame, there was a lot of pain, and a lot of inability to have any power within that lifetime. And so it helped me to understand that why it was difficult for me to put myself forward, you see, because within that putting myself forward came this danger of being struck down when I did that. And so by knowing this, it helped me a little bit along on my own path in being able to come to terms with that so that I did not have that deeply seated fear of putting myself forward in the world. And that still has been one of my biggest challenges in this lifetime. And yet, God has arranged it in a certain way that's exactly what's demanded of me. And so this is the way that it often is. The things that come most natural to us are sometimes things that we don't need to accentuate. And the things that come more difficult to us are the things that we have to move into and somehow find a way to overcome it. Because if we don't, that karma, or that set of actions that were put into place at that time, serve as a stumbling block for us. And you see, we are all the children of God. We are born in that perfection. We live in that light, in that perfection. And yet these coverings of karma cover over our consciousness in such a way that it limits that light. limits that purity of expression. And so unless we overcome those obstacles, you see, then that light within us does not get to shine forward fully, and we are held back from our own progress. So this idea, if it feels good, do it, and we just kind of go along with the flow, isn't always the thing to do. Sometimes those challenges are put in front of us because we have to develop the God-given will that we all have in order to overcome those challenges. So developing a will is very important. Now, how do we go about doing that? The best way is that in our everyday life, we pick out challenges for ourselves. And if we have difficulty in developing our will, then we pick out things that are easily attainable. But we do not let the sun set without having accomplished what that we set out to accomplish in that day. So whatever it is that you wake up in the morning and you say, this I will do today, then you do not let the sun set without accomplishing that. Now, gradually, just as somebody who is getting into proper condition, if they don't have a well-conditioned body, if you want to become a marathon runner and you've not been used to running, running 50 steps may be a great challenge, and you may be totally out of breath after 50 steps. That's all right. You set yourself that goal for going those 50 steps. And gradually, each day, you build on that a little more and a little more. And that consistency and that desire nature to fulfill that goal is what helps you along, you see. So to build our will and to begin to strengthen that, we begin to pick out tasks to do. And when we pick those tests and those tasks out, then we pursue those and we don't let them go. And gradually what you do is you begin to build up a magnetic field around you of will. Now, as Master said in the autobiography and the reading tonight, the will is something of the astral body, and that is the energy body that we are all endowed with. We have this physical body, and we are able to move around and have our being in it. But also, when we lose this physical body that is made up of these elements, we go someplace, our conscious mind. You know, when you go to sleep at night and you dream and you're able to create whole worlds all of their own, where does this come from? You know, physical scientists look at the brain and they look at the rapid eye movements and the synapses within the brain and they localize it there in the brain. But where does ideas come from? Where do thoughts come from? Where does those innate desires for growth come from? It is amazing in working with individuals who come from families that there's been a lot of violence in, that there's been not much desire for growth or for overcoming, but rather preying on one another and all the rest of it, that there is an individual here and there who want to go beyond their past, who has something innate within them that wants to grow. And you can't explain just where that comes from. If we are just a product of our environment, you would reason that they would just reinvent what has already been given to them. But that's not the way it is. It's amazing how durable we are. It's amazing how much punishment we can take, and we still keep coming back and wanting to grow, wanting to become more, wanting to perfect ourselves. And this is that spiritual grace that's within us. This is that spiritual nature that's inherent within us. And if we don't become so deluded by our experiences in this life, we retain some trace of a memory or an intuitive response to that. And so we begin to search out after that. Now, when we look for that path, there are many who look toward a religion, for instance, and they join a church and they become in the society of people who are trying to make their lives better, if that church is what it should be, and they learn good moral lessons and they try to do better with their lives. and this is good, and it's right for those individuals. But for those who want to progress just beyond good social influence or learning good moral lessons, but want to move into higher consciousness, then the teachings take on a deeper and more meaningful level. And oftentimes the churches, those repositories and places where that knowledge should be taught, is not taught. Rather, you are left with a social organization that does good of its own accord, but doesn't teach those inner lessons, those inner pathways. And so for that, then, they're embedded within the teachings, certainly within Jesus' teachings, and even within the Old Testament, the Judaic masters had those truths, even as the masters in India and in China and Japan and around the world, wherever there is a true master, they uncover those truths and they teach it. Now, each one according to its own language and metaphors and symbology that's appropriate to that culture. But each culture has those truths embedded within its great religions. And what is that truth? The truth is that we were born into this lifetime and have assumed an identity and a body that is not our truest and highest nature. That we can consciously gain access to this higher consciousness, to this higher nature, which is inherent to each one of us. Jesus said that it is our inheritance. It comes to us by nature. It is not something that we have to learn. It is not something that we have to become. But rather, it is something for us to uncover. And the uncovering it is moving away all the debris, all the assumptions, all the mental and emotional barriers that we have erected through lifetime after lifetime by becoming and developing a belief that we are just this body, that we are just a particular being here, that we have an infinite nature. And to be able to identify that nature first is a goal. Now, we cannot truly know what that nature is until we have experienced it. And perhaps at different times we get glimpses of that. We're looking out over the ocean and we feel our spirit just expand out to the horizon. And we feel ourselves enlarged. Perhaps we are up on a hillside and we are looking out and we feel ourselves expand. And we feel ourselves a part of all of nature and everything about us. And we feel a deep stillness and a peace, and perhaps a joy wells up in us that is natural. It is not because any particular thing is happening. It is not because there is any sensory stimulation, even in the view that's giving it that. It transcends all of that. And so this is the nature of which we are truly made up of. It is expansive. It is uplifting. It is finding its identity as a union with everything, every part of creation. It doesn't differentiate one between another. It gives us ideas and realizations and unfoldment consciously that we truly understand the nature of ourselves and of this universe. And it's not by reading a book or by taking on the ideas of someone who's spoken to us, but rather it is something that is innate and intuitive, and we truly realize it. We know it, and it resonates in every part of our being. Our entire body, our entire being just vibrates with that truth when we get it, and we know that it's true. We know it. And when we get that, then we know that we have been in touch with this higher nature, this spiritual nature, or God within us. And then as we continue along this path, these revelations, these realizations begin to expand, they begin to unfold. In the beginning, we may get a particular realization, And it's wonderful and it's perfect when we get it. But it's like a dream. And then waking up, the dream begins to recede away out of our consciousness beyond our own will. We want it to keep that memory, but it recedes back. And this is the way oftentimes that these revelations come in the beginning, that we get it and it's a beautiful, wonderful experience, but it gradually recedes from our conscious awareness. And then we begin to see how our mind begins to fill in the details and begins to twist it just a little bit, depending on how our mind is made up and how we try to give that form, how we try to fill in the details. But if we continue on, we unfold through the spine and through the brain. Now, within our spinal system are these wonderful astral centers. They are on the energetic level. And there it is that we encounter the origins of what animates this body, gives it consciousness, and yet it is beyond this body. And so it is part of the substance, it is part of the form that exists beyond this material body, so that when we die, in other words, when we leave the conscious being within this body, we are born into an astral body, or we reclaim that nature that was always ours. And we are lifted up into this new universe. And so there's this wonderful, shining universe that is much more expansive, much more uplifting than the current one that we live in. But really, it is right within you. You see, there is no place that you have to go. You don't have to die. What's been commonplace within the religion here in the West is that you have to die in order to enter into these heavenly realms. But this is not the truth. This is something that we're able to do consciously by becoming still and traveling that path within the spine. So as we move upwards along the spine, at the base is the lower regions, and this is where our lower unconscious and the lower desires are registered within the body. But as we move up, we begin to get more refined. And as we move into the heart chakra, this is the first transpersonal chakra that we move into. It goes beyond person. It's where our feeling state goes beyond what we have known up until that point. And so at the heart chakra, we find this ascending or this vertical force coming up the spine. And with it is the horizontal or this force that is coming from the back region and coming forward through the heart. And this is where the Battle of Armageddon happens. This is where the first part of the crucifixion happens, is at this fourth chakra level. And this is the tomb where the Christ, or that pure consciousness, has been entombed. And when it resurrects itself, you see, before it does that, there are 3 days that go by, and part of that experience is the graves are opened up and souls are taken out. Now, this is the lower unconscious, you see, needs to be purified, needs to be gone through. So when we start into these experiences, we are uplifted and we feel the purity of this Christ nature, this Krishna nature, this Buddha nature that we are all made up of. But then we are taken down into the lower unconscious and the graves are opened up. Those experiences, that karma from the past is released and opened up. And we have to face that nature, and it's not an easy thing to do. We feel as if during those times we've fallen from the path, we've fallen from our spiritual nature. But the truth is, we're right on the battlefield. We're right where we should be. And we need to hang on during those times. We don't get swept away with that negative force that's trying to take us out of that experience. but rather we hang on to God. And sometimes all we can do is hang on to the hem of God's robe. When we do that, it's just hanging on for dear life. But you don't get swept away with these negative forces. And if you hang on tightly and in faith, then you go and move through those experiences. And those lower natures are released and they are purified in this light. So you are once again lifted up and you get this purity of consciousness once again. And after a while of getting rest there and feeling the fullness of the spiritual consciousness, again, then you are plummeted back down into the lower unconsciousness. Now, if you don't know any better, you think that you have fallen from the path. And so oftentimes people get swept away during these times because they become discouraged. They think that they aren't any good. They think that they have lost it all. And there are many who are tested during these times, and there are many who don't stay the course. But if we stay the course, then that too is purified. And through each one of these experiences, we go through the purification and the upliftment, and then more purification and more upliftment. And if we stay true, if we stay steady, if we keep our minds and our consciousness focused upon God alone, practice loving every individual as we would ourselves, and keeping our minds purified and focused, then we will be led most directly to that highest spiritual state. And once the entire unconscious has been cleaned out and purified, then we can stay in that highest consciousness as a steady state. And this is the reign of the Christ for 1,000 years. You see, this is the 1,000-petaled lotus of the brain that opens up, and it's the fullness of our own God realization, and it's the perfection in it. And then we are a freed soul. In India, this is called being a Jiva Mukta, freed while living. And so what we have died to is our own sense of individual identity as separate from spiritual and pure consciousness. And then we live in that, and we are free. And we are free to stay and be in this body, or we are free to go at that point. You see, there is no karmic bonds. There is no desire nature that forces us to stay here. But there is also no impediment from us staying here, if that's what we choose. And so we are freed beings. No longer are we indebted by this karmic force of being in this body, or even in the astral body, this energy body, or even in the causal or the fine idea body. We are free to travel in any direction we choose, upwards or downwards. And there we can fulfill divine purpose as we feel inspired from moment to moment. But we are not bound by our actions, because each action is guided by wisdom. Most generally for us, our wisdom, our natures of the senses and of our habits guide us from moment to moment. And we like this situation and we don't like this situation. We attracted to one thing and we were repelled by another. And so because of our attachment and our identification with this lower nature, you see, our decisions are predicated upon those likes and dislikes. But when we enter into this higher spiritual consciousness, then we feel this inspiration come from deep within us. And we focus upon that, and that becomes our guidepost. And perhaps something leads us into a painful situation that by nature we would not want to move into. And yet we feel inwardly prompted in order to do that. And see, we're not compelled one way or the other. We're also not compelled to go into painful circumstances. Because we are free, And so we choose from moment to moment, and we are guided by this inner wisdom, even in the smallest details in our life. And so you see, this is being a totally freed individual. As long as our actions are guided by our likes and our dislikes and our habits and the lower nature and the lower mind, then we continue to build karma for ourselves. We continue to live in the world of cause and effect. And there are those who may say, well, the spiritual path is too tough, or it's too difficult, or I'll wait until some future time. But when will that time come? It doesn't get any easier. And in the meantime, we're only building more of this karmic bonds that keeps us in bondage and doesn't lead us to our freedom. So if we make the spiritual effort now, if we take time to become quiet within us and listening to that higher mind, then it begins to reveal itself. And it begins to take us through each experience just exactly as we need it. It's blueprinted exactly for us and no for nobody else. And so you can't look at somebody else's life and become a carbon copy of their life, but rather you become your own truest and highest nature. Now, in the beginning, this takes a great deal of concentration and a great deal of effort because we are so enculturated into this lower mind and to these habits and to the lower nature. But with a little bit of effort, and if we stay the course, gradually a sense of peacefulness, a sense of our true nature begins to shine forward. And we get these experiences a little bit by a little bit. And a little window opens up here, and then another one there. And we feel inspired, and we feel uplifted in those moments. And gradually, if we stay the course, and if we stay true, then this becomes more and more a part of our life. Until it's not anything that's vague. It's not anything that we think, well, is this something that's spiritual, or is it something a part of my imagination? It becomes so powerful, like a river flowing through you, that you are swept away with it, and you are guided by it. And you are inspired by it, and you are overwhelmed with it, and in awe of what is going on within you. And when you feel that peace that is so profound and so still that you can bear hold it and be in it because of its intense beauty and power, you see, then you know that you're on track. And when you feel your mind inspired, then you feel yourself not any longer searching for some vague knowledge, but rather you have gone to the source of knowledge and you have found it there. And so then, rather than running around after desires, you feel as if the whole universe is contained right within you. And when you feel that way, what is there to be afraid of? You see, we are afraid of other people's reactions. We're afraid what they'll think of us. We're afraid of criticism, or that people will think poorly of us. But when you see this entire universe as a manifestation of the one consciousness that is embedded within yourself, what is there to be afraid of? And you feel that love, that divine love flowing through your heart, and you feel it pouring out to everybody about you. You see? And you don't become somebody else. You don't become an automation, but rather you become your true self. And you feel free. And then you choose, not because you're compelled to, but because you feel the inner attunement. And that leads you step by step by step. So you see, this path is totally natural. It is something that we are all born to. And if we hear the call, and if we hear the wake up, reveille, and we decide to respond to it, we're given everything that we need, in order to uplift this consciousness, overcome all the obstacles, and become pure wisdom, pure love. And it's not just for one person. It's for each and every one of us. For everyone who's willing to make the effort to pay the price, it requires everything of us. And then we see the world as with one consciousness. It's an interesting story of Yogananda when he was still a young man. And there's a certain sect there in India that in order to overcome attachment towards taste of food and that kind of thing, that they mix all their food together. So everything that you might have for a dinner, they mix all together, including the water and everything else, they make a soup of it. And you will never make it into the culinary cookbooks, I can assure you. But in this way, he tested himself, and he felt like he would overcome something. And so one day he was walking along with a friend of his, Surendra, and he saw there this putrid rice. And the thought came in his own mind, because he was always thinking of God, and he had this God-tuned consciousness, that God was within this putrid rice as well as on the ground. And he saw a cow come along and sniff at the rice and backed up and just, oh, it's too disgusting for the cow to even think about. And he thought, oh, that cow is in ignorance. It doesn't see that it's God also. So he tells Surendra, he says, that rice is just as much God as any other food I've eaten. I'm going to take a handful. Surendra says, if you take a mouthful, I'll take a mouthful. So Master kind of playfully goes over and he takes a big handful of it and he starts eating it. It's disgusting mush. It's on the ground there. Well, Surendra just realized his mistake right away and took off running. So Master grabbed another handful and chased after him and took it and put it into his mouth. And Surendra not only got rid of that, but his lunch from earlier on in the day too. And he says, I've learned a good lesson here. Be careful what I promise when I tell you something. But Master didn't get sick from this rice because that inner awareness saw it as light and as the purity of God, even as everything is. And so when we operate and live in that consciousness, everything in our life becomes fit food. And this isn't just the food that we eat, but it's each and every experience that we have. And things that on the outward seem to be unpalatable, when we see that it is God at the core, that it's a manifestation of light, then it makes it fit food. It makes it fit for our consumption. And we don't get ill by it, but rather we can utilize it and make it into something more. The other day, I've been having very intense dreams where a lot of work is being done during the dream life. And so oftentimes when I've been waking up lately, it's being a little bit like being hit by a truck. And I wake up and my neck is stiff and my body feels like it's been for a workout. And indeed it has been throughout the night. And so I don't send those experiences away, but it's just all part of it. You see, it's all part of the working out. So when my body feels like that, I take it and I just, that's a reminder to chant God's name and to meditate on God. You see, the body is uncomfortable and it's in pain. And you can't forget God when your body is in pain if you use it as a reminder. There are a couple things that we can do with pain. One is we can just stay in the pain and we can be afraid of the pain. And that just makes the pain in our body worse. Or we can take it as a reminder to keep our mind upon God alone, to use it as a means for reminding us to sing to God, to love God, to make that God a part of our consciousness. during that time. And when we do that, and we take our mind off the pain and put it on to God, you see, generally, we're lifted up out of the pain then. And a harmony is restored within the body. And so, you know, this is a way to use something that's unpalatable in your life, something that looks like rotten rice that has no good merit to it. And you utilize that experience and you use it to transform your consciousness and to tap into that higher consciousness. If we use each and every one of the experiences that come to us as fodder for reminding ourselves of the goodness and the greatness of God, even those things that on the outside appear to be negative, we can uplift those and transform them into something that's new, because the consciousness within us is new. And so then every memory of something from the past that seems painful or negative can be a reminder to keep our mind upon God alone. If we begin to see God in that individual who did us wrong, not because we approve of the wrong that was done, but because it uplifts our own consciousness. You see, Jesus said to love your enemy. Why is this? Is it for the benefit of the enemy? Well, it is for the best benefit of the enemy, as in it blesses them by your own thoughts. But more to the point, it is a blessing to yourself. Because if you hold hatred in you, if you hold that anger with you in you, then that will eat away at you. And it will create dis-ease within this body. And gradually, if it's held long enough, it creates dis-ease. And so it is for our own best and highest benefit not to hang on to it. Now, we all have human reactions to individuals and situations in this life. And that does not mean that we should be a goody-two-shoes that never gets angry or never feels any kinds of emotion. That's not it. It's that we let go of it. As soon as we experience it, we let go of it. And we ask God to bless that individual. We see to the light of God within that individual. And if we do that, we send a blessing to that. And you may say within your mind, they don't deserve it. But I tell you, if you were able to see the light of God within them, and it actually manifested, they would feel acute pain at what they have done, the transgressions and the wrongs that they have done, and they would begin to repent from their previous actions. And what better gift, what better thing could happen than that? So it doesn't mean that you're a doormat. You stand up for yourself and you give back all the power of God within you when you need to. And you stand up for what's right and for the truth. But you give it back in love. You can give it back strongly so that Jesus, even when he overturned the tables and whipped the money changers that were in the temple, you see, it was an act of love. It was an act of divine love. But it was done very powerfully and very strongly. But there, if you act in that love, there is no residue left over. You see, when you're done with it, you're done with it. There's a story of some disciples who were going to visit Krishna. And so they came to a river, and they had brought some offerings for Krishna, for him to eat. And so the boatman said, I'll take you across, but give me what you have to eat. And they said, well, this is for Krishna. And he says, never mind, you give it to me, and I'll take it, and then I'll make sure that you can get across the river and see your beloved. And so they rather reluctantly, seeing no other choice, said okay, and they gave it to him. And so he ate it all the way down. And so then the fellow says, he says, so you think I've taken your food from your offering to Krishna? He says, I tell you that each bite that I ate of it, I offered up to Krishna internally. Well, the devotees were very skeptical about this. and they express that. He says, I tell you what. He says, if I have not eaten anything here today, the river will part and you will be able to go safely across. And so they were very amazed at this. And so he walked up to the edge of the river and he loudly announced to the river, he says, if I have eaten anything here, he says, then do not part for me, otherwise part. And suddenly, just as in the Old Testament with Moses, the river parted, and the disciples, very amazed, quickly scampered across and got to the other side. And there is Krishna sleeping underneath the tree on the other side, and they got there and respectfully waited, and finally Krishna kind of roused himself, and he says, oh, you have come, I see. And they said, yes, we apologize, sir, but this fellow on the other side demanded our offerings to you. He says, oh, that fellow, he ate so much it made me tired, and now I've had to take a rest, you know, this whole time. And so by this means of offering it up to God, he took none of it into his own system, and it all went to Krishna. And Krishna was so tired out because he had eaten too much of the food. And this is the way that it is with a pure heart and a pure consciousness, that if we offer everything to God, everything that comes our way, it passes right straight through us. And the lovely thing about this is that God's blessings then pass right back through us out into the world. And so we take nothing for ourselves, and we give as nothing from ourselves but what God within us has to give. And so we live this life then, you see, as a hollow reed, or as the flute that Krishna plays, is beautiful music. And really the flute loves nothing more than for the master musician to play its lovely melodies through. And so each one of us then become a flute that the Christ or the Krishna plays beautiful music through. And that is our greatest glory, and we have no desires of our own but to be this perfect instrument for divine consciousness to flow through us and everywhere about us. And we take nothing for our own, and we give nothing as our own, but see it nothing but as the play and the wonder and the beauty of God. A lovely story. I've been talking here for some time and don't know if there are any questions. We have some new people here tonight and some others who have been practicing and putting these things into practice. So if anybody has any questions, we can throw it open to that. Everybody all filled up? At the base of the spine is the Muladhara chakra, which is connected directly with the sexual organs. And during that time, when at the base of the spine is stored in an immense amount of life energy. And with that, typically we're used to expressing it out to the world through sexual energy. And when we begin to transmute it and transform it and lift it up in consciousness, the sexual organs are stimulated during that time. And so if we keep the consciousness tuned within ourselves, and gradually it's almost as if a trap door is sprung open at the base of the spine, and that life energy begins to flow up through the spine rather than being guided out through the sexual organs. And so it's a time to really stay the course. It's a good sign, actually, that you're accessing that primal life energy that's there. and it's ready to get lifted up, but it needs to, through continued concentration, then that trap door gets sprung open and suddenly you'll feel a rush of this kundalini or this spiritual energy, life energy coming up through your spine. And then it begins to do its work of transformation. And through each level of the chakras, then it comes up and it stimulates and it feeds those chakras. But with each one of those comes a challenge, because there's a positive and a negative on each side. And the negative, so to speak, is that channels it out to the world. Typically, when we live in this life, we wake up in the morning, everything is dedicated to going out to the world and doing things. And so this is what it's meant in the Bible when it says that you only offer up burnt offerings to God, that we burn out all this life force just through the senses. And so in meditation, it's reversing that. What normally comes in through the medulla to the brain and is distributed down through the spinal centers and then out through the senses, we withdraw from the senses and we guide back up to the spine, to the third eye point, and then up to the Sahasrara, the crown chakra up here. And so with each chakra then, there is this push and pull, this positive and negative. And one minute we feel lifted up, and the next we feel just this tremendous rush of energy going out through the senses and through the lowest chakra. It's through sexual organs. Through the next one, it's great fears that come up, fears for our own life, fears for the life of the world. We fear as if we're going to die, or as if the world is going to go through a cataclysmic kind of change, and we'll even see visions and that kind of thing around that. And so there's this tremendous push and pull that goes on beyond that. If we're able to stay the course, we come up into the next chakra, and that's around personal will. And we even encounter powers that go beyond what we're normally accustomed to, and we're tempted into moving into those and utilizing those. If we're able to stay the course there, we're lifted up into the heart chakra. And there we feel this divine love. And it's the first time that we go beyond the personal into the transpersonal. But we have specific objects of love. And so if we're able to transmute that and universalize that love, then we are lifted up into the fifth chakra, and that's the level of truth. And we learn the truth, and we're able to speak the truth there. And we can also become quite egotistical and opinionated at that point. And we, again, narrow at that. We think we're the only ones with the truth, and we don't universalize it. But again, if you can stay the course and universalize it, then you go to the sixth chakra. And this is where Jesus was referring to in terms of giving up the Son of Man, or the human ego, and giving up the ghost, which is also the human ego, and transmuting it into the Holy Ghost, or the divine self. And so even though Jesus was totally attuned to God and one with God, there was still this thin veil of separation. There is still the identity of the Son of Man and the Son of God, or the Son of Man and Father God. And so there is still that duality. And so through the crucifixion then, he totally transcended that and went beyond all thought of duality, all thought of myself and God. And there is a total transmutation and a oneness of consciousness. And so then that's going up into the highest crown chakra, and there is no polarity, there's no duality. So it's a good sign, because you're actually tapping into that wonderful life current there. But it also can be tremendously challenging during that time, and distracting. And so just let it go. Just let that go and keep your mind focused. And gradually you'll get that release. And, you know, this is the inner meaning around Shakti and Shiva, is that Shakti is the upcoming current, or this primal feminine energy that comes up to the masculine up here at the third eye point. And there's this union between the feminine and the masculine. And you see, we've been so enculturated all of our lives to look outside for that partner, to look outside to take that energy out to. But when we enter into this inner mystical path, it's an inside job. It's something where the sexual energy is actually lifted up inwardly, and the union happens within us. And that's unconsciously what we're seeking when we're seeking out sexual partners, is we're seeking that union. But it's by finding that polarity outside of ourselves, and this is finding the polarity and the union right within our own spine. So then there's no other place to go. And when we feel that, it's continuous union, where a sexual union can just be a temporary and a sporadic thing. It can be, when it's spiritualized and uplifted, it can be a beautiful thing in God. But also, if we want that continuous union, we want that continuous upliftment. And the yogis say that having union with God is like as good as 10,000 orgasms. You know, so if we want to be hedonists, we should be spiritual hedonists and look for that joy, look for that bliss, look for that union right within us. Yeah. So just stay the course. Just let that go. Continue your meditation and you'll get that release and that upliftment. It can be quite a test though. Yeah. It's something that, in her experience, she just naturally, it left her, that desire for that kind of sexual union. And but it was something that she valued. It's not something that she looked down upon. She actually cried when that experience came to her, and she no longer had that desire. It was no longer active any longer. But it's not an either or kind of a situation. But when you get into these experiences, there is a time when it is best to abstain. This Christ seed is formed with the secretions that come from glandular systems right within us. And so this Christ seed then comes down through the ganglionic nervous system and is deposited behind the tiny conical-like cave that's behind the stomach. And Bethlehem means house of bread. And so Joseph and Mary refer to two of the glands, the pineal and the pituitary gland, right within us. And with secretions that come from them, then the seed is formed and comes down. During that time, and the seed drops down every 28 and a half days, it follows the lunar cycle. And during that time, Herod, or the passions, comes up and seeks the... In the biblical story, Herod was going to kill all the children. And this is symbolic of expelling the seed during that time for both men and for women. And so the sexual desire comes up in an attempt to expel that seed, and that's the opposing force. And it's during that time when we're seeking to spiritually advance that we withhold ourselves, we withhold from sexual union during that time. And if we pass through that time, then the seed drops down to the base of the spine. And from there, then it begins its upward ascent through the spine. So if we're looking to make spiritual advancement, then there are times when we need to withhold ourselves from that. But it's not an either-or kind of a situation. For the spiritual aspirant, it's one of Mother's rules was to be married if you're going to have sexual union with someone, so that you had that committed relationship with another person and that commitment was there. But then, you know, through that, then you feel the upliftment during the sexual act and you feel it spiritualized and you feel yourself as much as a spiritual being as you do as a physical being during that. And in a human sense, it can represent some of the very highest experiences. But when we're ready for this spiritual upliftment, then there comes those times when we need to withhold from that, and then we get this seed that comes up. But, you know, when it's done in balance, and when it's done in love, and when the union comes about in that way, then it's very beautiful, it's very uplifting, and it's very edifying during those times, yeah. So when I first met Mother and came on the spiritual path, I was 20 years old. And, you know, it was a difficult time because I had been a sensual, sexual individual. And I used to have dreams, and I came to call this image that came in the dreams as the temptress. And it was doesn't take much to interpret the symbology, but I would be walking along on the path, and here would be the temptress, and would come in the forms that normally I wouldn't find attractive at all, almost made up as a prostitute and very gaudy kind of makeup and that kind of thing. And so it was encountering this form time after time, and gradually within my own dreams becoming a conscious dreamer and waking up within my own dream and saying no, and sometimes just screaming it. Fortunately, it didn't come out of my mouth. It just was something mentally that I said. But it was a terrifically difficult time, and really struggling with this. But when this avenue was created within my own spine, then it relieved all of that pressure that before was going out through the sexual organs. And the bliss and the power and the feeling of freedom and God around that was just tremendous. So it can be a very much a real struggle. And for Mother, it was a natural kind of giving up. And so once you have that release and that transformation, it becomes a regular feature, then it's not nearly so much of a struggle. Yeah, you're free from that. And that's a much preferable state to be in my book. And it doesn't stop you from moving in that place, but you don't feel compelled towards it. You don't feel driven towards it. This is, you know, because of our culture and the taboos that have been put around this and everything else, there's so many mixed messages around this. There's so much that has been talked around. And so it's something to be very careful about learning. It's the most powerful force in the universe when you think about it. It's a manifestation of the same creative force that's put all of this universe into creation. And so it's a terrifically powerful force that's embedded in our beings. And so it's not something, it's really something that's very sacred. And, you know, it's not about it being dirty or abhorrent or any of those kinds of things. You know, so many of the messages that we've gotten. but it's something to be treated with respect. And it has a sacred intent when it's uplifted and transmuted. Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, it's the very substance of life energy. And that's beautiful. It's golden. It's wonderful. And when you see the power of it, when it goes through a transformational and starts putting you through a transformational process, wow. It's something to behold. And there's ways that it's misused. I mean, so much of what we see today in films and other things, it's not beautiful. It's not uplifting. It's not edifying. And so I feel a great loss around that in ways that it's symbolized so oftentimes, that it doesn't represent the sacred union between two individuals. Rather, it's treated very cheaply. And so in that way, too, by not treating it as something that's sacred and wonderful, it's turned into something that's quite tawdry and not edifying. It's degrading. And so some fine balance between the two of those. Certainly that it's unnatural or that it's bad or it's the downfall of mankind and all those, you know. No, those need to be treated very carefully. Mm-hmm. Well, because of this polarity that exists right within us, from the top of the brain down to the bottom of the spine, that originally, as Sri Yukteswar talked about it, that we could inhabit this body and that we could maintain a freedom about it. We weren't rooted in it. And so through those times, and it's said that during the Golden Ages that children could be materialized just openly, or that a woman's womb could be quickened and that a baby could be created in that way, and that birthing was not the painful ordeal that it is today. And so through the desire nature to go more into the material body then, the energies were guided down through past the heart chakra into the three lower chakras. And it was there then that individuals lost their awareness of their spiritual natures and they became rooted in the body. And this is more closely and clearest symbolized in the sexual chakra getting stimulated and then looking outside of yourself for your complement rather than finding it as something within. So it's the fall from that consciousness of oneness, and that's most clearly delineated by having the polarity from the top of the head to the bottom of the spine. And so in this way, it symbolized that then it's moving into the midst of the garden and that the tree or the spine and enjoying the fruits of it, falling into that nature of things and becoming attached and losing consciousness of our oneness. Yeah.
Because that's where it gets confusing, because it is that.
Well, when we were in our most pure natures and in that oneness, that there wasn't that outward kind of desire, even while inhabiting bodies. But that's not the place that we find ourselves today, generally. And so, our intent is to return back to that nature of oneness. And when you're in existence in that, generally speaking, you don't feel that outward urge. You don't feel that outward compulsion towards seeking out. And it's when it becomes a compulsion, you see. And that's what removes us from this feeling of oneness that exists right within us. And so it's not the energy itself, but it's when it becomes of a compulsive nature. And it can be difficult to walk that balance between the two. Yeah. But in terms of the seed and the Herod nature, there are times when we need to withhold it, and so that it can make the root. Yeah.
Anything can obsess with anything.
Mm-hmm.
It just almost seems to me like, oh, she went
on,
it seems like
she
goes to see next to another obsession.
Mm.
You know?
Mm.
To reverse one.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, it's the upliftment that comes with it. And that's the difference. Because otherwise, it just feels like you're losing out on something. But when there's the uptake, when there's the upliftment, and you feel the union inside of yourself, then you don't feel like you're giving up on something. You don't feel like you're missing out on something.
Yeah.